Welcome into Light the Lamp here on DuckStream. I'm Alexis Downey. Happy to be joined today by ESPN rules analyst and former NHL referee Dave Jackson. Dave, thank you so much for taking the time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Of course. And I really was looking forward to this because getting your perspective and hearing your perspective on these ESPN broadcasts is always interesting to me. So I want to start by just talking a little bit about yourself, introducing you to some of our Ducks fans, your background. You're from Montreal. You grew up there and you got into refereeing there in your early days.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in Montreal, it's kind of tough not to be involved in hockey. I mean, my dad built a backyard rink, I think, from the time I was 2 years old, and everybody wanted to play, you know, for the Montreal Canadiens back then. I mean, I'm of an era where that was Guy Lafleur, Yvon Cornway, Larry Robinson. I mean, they won the cup, and they won the cup five times in the 70s. And I was going to school at the time, in elementary school, and we, you know, always be watching the Stanley Cup parade and everything. So everybody wanted to play pro hockey, and I was no different. You know, you grew up playing hockey, playing travel hockey. But I started refereeing hockey when I was 14 years old. I was still playing. I hadn't given up on the dream, but I figured I had a paper route where I had to deliver the newspaper at 6 a.m. And I hated that. I'm not a morning guy. So I figured I could make more. Yeah.
I was going to say, thanks for joining us this morning then.
Well, with the time change, it's not bad.
Yeah.
But I was able to make more money refereeing little kids hockey than I was delivering papers at 7 a.m. So I got into refereeing, and you got to remember back in the day, like even when you played top tier travel hockey, the kids now, they're on the ice 7 days a week. Back then, top tier travel hockey, we were only on the ice maybe 3 days a week, tops. So I had lots of extra time, spare time to just referee hockey and stay in the game. And, you know, you work on your skating, you work on everything. So, but then by the time I was 16, 17, I realized the dream was dead as a player and that I wasn't getting drafted. So I just, you know, I intended to go to college and stay just referee hockey for pocket money, basically. And I guess I was good enough at it because before long I was working the Q, and I went to a referee school in the summer of 86. Because Brian Lewis was there. Brian Lewis ended up being my boss who hired me, but he was a newly created director of development. And he was going to this school because it was run by a former NHL referee. And he was sort of doing the guy a favor. Like, I'll come to your school and see if you have any prospects and give your school sort of some authenticity. And I went there, and I stood out, but it wasn't like there was a whole ton of talent at the school. It was a lot of beginner referees. Brian Lewis invited me to training camp. I was 21 years old. He said, any interest in coming to training camp and seeing if you want to make this a career? And it took me about a millisecond to answer yes. And I went there in 1986, and I stayed there for 32 years.
Wow.
So it was a good run, and it was probably a good decision I made.
So the moment at the school, was that when you realized, oh, hey, I can really make this a career?
Pretty much. I was just enrolled in college, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I hadn't picked a major. I wasn't really enjoying going to college at that point in my life. I was a 21-year-old kid without direction, really. I knew I loved refereeing hockey. I knew I wanted to stay in the game. And when he offered me that chance, it was just like, yeah, I can remember driving home. It was about a 2-hour drive home. I'd been there all week, and I just, alone in my thoughts and going, I really have a chance to embark on a career if I play my cards right. And, I went to training camp, and I spent parts of seven seasons working the minor leagues. It wasn't like I went to camp and all of a sudden they, you know, parachute you into the NHL. It's a long process. And back then, don't forget, you're just one referee. So the apprenticeship program in the minors took a little longer because, you know, they throw you an NHL game, you're by yourself, sink or swim. They're not pairing you with a veteran and sort of like, let's see how it goes. I mean, it's the real deal. And I was probably unprepared when I finally did my first NHL game. And funny thing was, my first NHL game, Guy Lafleur was playing.
Oh.
So going back to earlier in the conversation, growing up in Montreal, watching Guy Lafleur. Now he retired and then he came back and he was playing for the Quebec Nordiques. Mm-hmm. And that was my first game. But being out there on the ice with Guy Lafleur, I was just like, wow, this is my welcome to the NHL moment. And everybody always asks me, how do you, when you're on the ice with your childhood heroes, how do you stay objective? Like, how do you not favor some players? But you realize after spending 7 years in the minors, you meet all these players who, you know, call you names and swear at you and you have battles with them and all that. By the time you get to, like, for example, doing the Montreal Canadiens game, the CH on the sweater is really all that is left from your childhood memories. The actual players wearing them are all guys you've battled with for 7 years in the minors. They're not the people you grew up idolizing. They're just another hockey team, the same as every other team in the league. So it was pretty easy, the transition. And it's something that I probably worried about initially when I was first hired. But by the time I got to the NHL, I was like, this is just one of 32. Well, back then it was one of 21 teams, 22 teams. But it was really easy to separate your childhood from your career.
So would you say then those early days of starting, working your way up, working in juniors and then working your way up, those helped you prepare for when you eventually got to the NHL really well?
Oh, absolutely. Just everything. I'm a 21-year-old kid. It was my second time on an airplane in my life.
Oh.
So, you know, from going through airports to checking in hotels to renting cars. I mean, there were some states I was in where I couldn't rent a car unless I was 24 or 25. So, I mean, I had to find transport some of these rinks I was doing. And literally, I had one referee sweater with a Velcro patch, and I just kept ripping the patch off and putting on a different patch. I worked all three junior leagues in Canada. I worked the IHL, I worked the American League, and I did a little bit of NCAA in the CCHA as well. So you had seven different rule books. It was crazy. I mean, but I wouldn't want to go back and do that. But at the time, it was the greatest time of my life. It was, you know, I wasn't making any money, but as a 21-year-old kid, I was making a ton of money. And it was a lot of fun. But you learn a lot of stuff down there. You make a lot of mistakes when you're in the minors. And I think you have to make mistakes in order to get better. Mm-hmm. And you just, when you make a mistake, you just try and make sure you don't make the same mistake twice. And, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have a story from a learning moment for you early in your career? I'm sure you have a lot of stories.
You could probably fill a book with learning stories. There was one, and it wasn't even really about refereeing hockey. It was just about the culture of being in the pros. So I had this player come up to me in the American Hockey League, who back then was getting a bonus for penalty minutes. And he asked me if I'd give him a misconduct because the game was out of reach. The story, they're either winning or losing, but it wasn't going to change the game. So I said, well, I can't just give you 10. You got to do something to earn it because I'm going to look like a fool if I just bang you for nothing. And he goes, okay. So he comes back out next shift and he raises his arms in the air and slams the stick with his stick on the glass, and I give him 10, tee him up, and out he goes. He's gone. And the captain comes over the boards, comes right at me. He's just all over me, right? About me being thin skinned and everything and all that. And I told the captain, I go, he asked me to do it. He wanted the 10 minute misconduct. So the next night, I got the same team. That player comes out and he's irate at me. He goes, you're not supposed to tell my teammates that I asked you. That's supposed to stay between you and I. And I was so naive that I didn't realize that back then. But he clued me in, and we just laughed about it. You know, the player was a really good guy. But that's just one thing that, you know, you're 21, 22 years old doing pro hockey, and you just have no idea what the culture's like. And the things that happen on the ice, they stay on the ice. And some of the stuff that's said between players and between coaches needs to stay between the two of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And you bring up a good point, just your interactions with players. And it sounds like it's gone to where you've gotten to really know them over the years, especially, you know, with how long you were an NHL referee as well. What is it like building those relationships and then going into a game and then seeing, you know, the familiar faces? But of course, you know, doing your job.
That's what I miss probably the most.
Yeah.
I can be honest. I don't honestly miss the the pressure leading up to the game, or or the feelings. I mean, referees make mistakes, and you know, God knows I, again, could probably fill a book on the mistakes I've made. And some of them keep you up at night. Some of them you're lying in bed and you're staring at the ceiling going, like, how could I have made that call? Or how did I miss that call? And it really affects you. And I'm sure glad I wasn't on social media back then, because when I see what goes on social media, now that I'm pseudo in the media and I, you know, I follow Twitter and all that, and I just go, if I'd have been on social media back then, it was soul crushing. But you make mistakes, or you make tough calls, and you have to deal with coaches, you have to deal with players. Some of them are really angry at you. And then, unfortunately, back, what I found was, back when I started, so my first NHL game was 1990. Okay. Most teams didn't charter back then. It wasn't until the early 2000s, I believe, they started chartering. So you could have a battle with a team, like a real battle.
Yeah.
And then you'd end up in the local watering hole after the game, and half the team's in there. And you're like, oh no, we better leave, because, you know, I just had a, you know, knockdown, drag him out argument with this so-and-so. And before you know, he's coming over buying you a beer. And you talk and you get to know the guy and he gets to know you. So next time you're on the ice, you know, you're still got a job to do, but there's a bit of a mutual respect, a bit of a rapport, which is kind of cool. Funny story. Back, it was probably around early 2000s, Ty Domi was, who's a great guy. Ty is tougher than nails, but big heart and a really good guy. And he never really gave the officials any problems. He respected us and we respected him as well. We're on the road in Calgary and we were doing the Maple Leafs in Calgary the next night. And I walked into an Italian restaurant and Ty was sitting there with some teammates. And we sat at the bar and we kind of waved and all that. And on the way out, Ty just came by and we spoke for 2 or 3 minutes and he left. And we stayed another 45 minutes or so. And we asked for our bill. And the waitress said, no, it was your bill's taken care of. It was that guy that was you were talking to earlier. He paid for dinner for you guys. And that was for me and the two guys I was with. And it was really nice. And that wasn't him trying to get an edge. That was just Ty being Ty. He was a great guy. So the next night, we're out on the ice pregame before the anthem. And we're skating around. And I slide by Ty and I say, Ty, that was really nice what you did last night buying us dinner, but don't think it's going to buy any breaks. And he kind of mock horror. He looks at me, he goes, I would never do that to try and get a break. So we laughed. And then I kid you not, 30 seconds into the game, guess who I tossed out? Yeah. Ty. I threw Ty out of the game, literally probably a minute into the game. And, it was kind of funny. Looking back on it now, it was kind of funny because I told him that, you know, buying us dinner wasn't going to earn you any breaks. And, you know, his night wasn't very long.
No, that's so funny. Part of it, too, with officiating is the travel. I mean, you're on the road a lot throughout the year, throughout the season. What did you like about that? What didn't you like about that? Did it help build your relationships with your other referees with you?
Yeah. So what people don't realize, I mean, you look at an NHL player, especially with chartering now, they play 41 road games. And that means they're probably only on the road, what, maybe 65, 70 nights a year.
Yeah.
Excluding playoffs. We don't charter. We usually, we carry our own equipment with us, checking bags, unpacking our bags, finding laundromats, you know, washing our equipment. We're on the road probably 20 days a month.
Wow.
And easily over 150 nights a year. And we factor in training camp, exhibition games, and playoffs. You get your summers off, you know. Most guys don't work the finals. So you're done in May sometimes, sometimes April if you haven't had a great season. And you're off till Labor Day. So you have a nice summer to spend with your family. But the tough part of being on the road, and I love being on the road, especially in some of the great cities. Either you've got good weather, you can go play golf. Usually have a day off between games. Unlike players, we don't have team meetings. We don't have have practices. We don't have to go to game day skates. I mean, our time, just be at the game. Don't miss your game. you go to cities like New York, Washington, the LA area, beautiful weather. You go see concerts, you can go see movies, you go see plays, and someone else is paying for you to be there. So it's really take advantage. I always tell the young guys now, take advantage of being on the road. Don't just stay in your hotel room or go down to the hotel bar. Like, get out and explore a city, because there's people that never get to leave their state. And they, I mean, they would kill to be able to do what we do. We go to 32 great cities, and there's so much culture, there's so much to see that I loved it. The downside was when you start having a family, you miss a lot of things. You miss your kids' school plays, school concerts. If your kids play hockey or play sports, you're missing a lot of their games. That's a real downside, and that's tough. So there's a bit of give and take.
Yeah. Did you have a favorite city to travel to?
Probably New York City, which was great because there's three teams in that area. Yeah. So you got to go to New York. A lot of times you get to spend four to six days there, which is kind of cool. Washington, D.C. There's so much to see in Washington. And then, of course, when I came in the league, I believe the only Sunbelt team was the LA Kings. And San Jose was just in, I think. And then, of course, then you get Anaheim, you get Dallas, you get two teams of Florida and Carolina. I mean, it's really nice leaving, because being from Montreal, I lived in Montreal until about 2000.
Okay.
So I spent to try and get out of winter and go to one of these Sunbelt cities was pretty nice as well. You just didn't want to show up at the game with a suntan. You had to be careful you didn't fall asleep at, you know, by the pool or something.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any memories coming out to Anaheim for games?
I do. I have a lot of memories getting lost going to Anaheim, because when they first came in the league, guys were used to staying in L.A. We just stayed at the airport, LAX. Mm-hmm. And guys, old habits die hard. And the guys were like, well, we're not going to, because they probably have a game in LA too. So you're not, we travel so much that unpacking and packing is a real pain.
Yeah.
So you like to just get to your hotel room, be able to hang your clothes up and stay for 3 or 4 days. So a lot of times guys would have like a game in LA, day off, game in Anaheim, day off, game back in LA. So they would say, like, let's just stay in LA. But not banking on the amount of traffic and the amount of freeways involved. Yeah. I mean, I can remember back then too, we didn't have the GPS on our phones. Mm-hmm. So we were like airline pilots. You had a navigator beside you
with the map
and charts out, and realizing it was upside down. No, you got to take this freeway and go that way. Mm-hmm. It was, there were some scary nights where I thought we were going to miss the game.
Oh, geez.
And then guys started realizing staying in Anaheim is actually pretty nice. So now guys have no qualms of staying there. It's a beautiful city, a beautiful place to get out and do things. And I always loved going to Anaheim. I love the rink. I love the weather. I love the hotels around there, restaurants. So it's I actually miss going there.
Oh, well, you have to come visit sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to.
How has the, with the way the game has changed, how has officiating changed with it?
That's a great question. The game has certainly changed.
Yeah.
And I think when we had one referee on the ice, there was a certain standard that kind of everybody got. And it was a very loose standard. If you watch games from the 90s, even the early 2000s, the clutching and grabbing and hooking and holding was, I mean, it was rampant. If a guy didn't literally fall down as a puck carrier, you didn't make a call. Mm-hmm. And forget guys without the puck. I mean, you could do whatever you wanted to them, basically. And it was a function of one referee can only see so much. And that was the accepted sort of standard. I mean, I can remember watching games on TV where a referee would miss a call and the announcers would go, oh, the referee's using good judgment. He's choosing not. No, the referee just missed the call. Mm. And then that's changed so much nowadays, you're not allowed to miss a call.
Yeah.
And I say not allowed. Players, coaches, fans, they expect you to make that call. So I think it was twofold. When they came with the, I think it was 2005, coming out of the lockout, they decided they're going to really clamp down and allow the skilled players to show their skill. I mean, they were skating in mud before that, and they just couldn't move. They're being hooked, being held, water skiing behind them. But hand in hand, you had to have two referees on the ice, because there's no way that one referee can maintain that standard. It's just, you'd be guessing if you, because you're always following the play. So even sometimes now, they'll bring me on and ask me, a referee will get hurt. Mm-hmm. And they'll go, I have to revert back to the old three-man system. And they say, what can we expect? I said, well, you could probably expect the standard to be a lot looser because you've got a referee now following the play. He's looking at the puck carrier's back. He's unable to see if that stick gets in his hands or whatever. So that's probably the biggest difference is that now we have a referee in a much better position, mm-hmm. plays coming at him, and we allow skilled players to showcase their skill. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, I think it was you allowed the lowest common denominator to be impactful. Mm-hmm. A guy who was slow, a guy that can only hook and hold, he was a sought-after player because he was shut down, right? He'd shut the other team's offense down. Now you can't do that.
One of the other parts about the game is just how fast it's become as well. Does that change the conditioning for officials on the ice? I mean, it seems like, you know, the puck is moving so quickly and to make sure your body is positioned in the right way to make those calls or to see the play.
Oh, the game is, it's so much faster than when I started. And we've taken away the center ice red line, right, for the two line pass. So back when I started the one referee, you can only make the pass up to center ice. If the guy caught the pass over center ice, it was a whistle. So players with a lot of speed had to slow down at the red line or else they would have been offside on those passes. You got rid of the red line. Now guys are, you know, being hit full stride at the far blue line. There's no way one referee keep up to that. It's just, it's just way too fast. And you look at back when it was one referee, most guys retired in their mid to late 40s. Because just physically, you couldn't keep up with it.
Yeah.
Now guys are going to the 55 because you're only covering half the ice. The biggest difference, you have to be a really good backward skater now. When it was one referee, you went end-to-end forward, did a big loop, and back you came. Now you do your hard skating when the play's coming at you, and you're skating backwards. So that's been a big difference for guys that want to referee. Make sure you can skate backwards, not just forwards. Mm-hmm. But conditioning has always been something the league has really harped on. People think we just show up for our first game and away we go. I mean, we get a week-long training camp and day one's the medicals. Day two is the actual physical tests.
Yeah.
And they put you through. I mean, they pull the body fat calipers out. They got it, you know, they're pinching your love handles, going, you know, make sure you don't have too much body fat. You get on the bike, you do the Wingate test, you do the VO2 max, push-ups, sit-ups, long jump, leg strength, shuttle runs. I mean, very similar to what players go through at training camp.
Yeah.
The only difference probably being like, we don't do any kind of bench press or whatever. They don't test your upper body strength. But as far as conditioning goes, it's probably just as stringent as what the NHL players go through.
And is that held before the season starts, similar to when the players are having their training camp?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it happens about a week before the players have their training camp. That way, when the camp breaks for the officials, they can then start traveling to do the exhibition games that the players are taking.
Are you still involved in any committees or anything? Or is it just more, you know, now you're just giving advice to, you know, the next generation and then working with ESPN?
Well, it's funny. When I retired, the league did hire me as a officiating manager, which there's about 7 or 8 of them on staff, and they're retired officials who just, they constantly, that's their job. They go around rink to rink and they watch the game. They act as a sort of a middleman sometimes between the general manager who might be upset at some calls. He'll come and vent to the officiating manager, and then officiating manager will go down. He'll debrief the referees after the game. And it's, you know, you guys did, so you act as sort of, you're there to rate the officials. You're there to teach the officials. Mm-hmm. It truly is like a coach,
yeah.
An officiating coach. And I did that for 2 years, really enjoyed it. I really thought it was my calling. I enjoyed mentoring. Then COVID hit and we were furloughed for about 1.5 years. Mm-hmm. And then I was set to come back, and that's when ESPN called and offered me the TV gig, and I jumped at it.
What did you think when they called and gave you this opportunity?
I thought it was awesome. And I thought it would be a lot easier than it was when I started, because for years I would sit on the couch watching hockey, and you know, the play-by-play or the color guy would be explaining a rule. A lot of them know the rules really well, but there's occasionally times where they don't know the rule and they explain it incorrectly. And I'd be on the couch kind of losing my mind, explaining to my wife what the call actually was. And she goes, you know, too bad you're not on TV explaining it the way they do in football and all that. So when they called me, I was like, oh, great. My wife goes, great. Finally, you get a chance to do what you did. But I didn't realize that in my tirades and my rants on the couch, they lasted about 3 minutes. I only get about 20 seconds on TV. So when I started, I would start to be building this sort of circular story, but then I'd be sort of realizing that halfway through, like my time was done and I didn't get a chance to sort of wrap it up. And I felt that I was actually leaving the viewer with more questions than I answered. I created more questions because I was trying to like lay out a linear thing. But so I had to learn to be a lot more crisp, a lot more concise, and try and just get out the important points and explain what I'm doing. And there's really no, sometimes there's really no right or wrong answer, because it comes down to human judgment. So I can give my opinion on what the rule is, or what the criteria is, what they're looking at, and here is what the rule says. But it doesn't mean that what I think is going to be the same thing as the situation Mitrella thinks. So I'm sometimes hesitant to say it's definitely going to be a goal or definitely not going to be a goal, because, you know, what I see might not be the same as what they see.
What does a game night look like for you when you're working a game with ESPN? Are you at home? Are you in the studio? Do you have a bunch of TVs? Or how are you watching the games?
I'm in the studio in Bristol, usually for opening night. And opening night, the Frozen, what is it called? Frozen Frenzy, when we had all 32 teams playing. Usually first round of the playoffs, I'm in studio, because we literally could have four games going at a time. You know, you get two early games and then two late games. If those early games go on overtime, I've got four games going on at once. And I've got literally four screens and I'm just scanning with like 12 voices in my head, all the play-by-play. And you can't really enjoy a game. You're just watching for carnage, right? You're just watching to see if there's a goaltender lying in a space, or there's somebody complaining, there's a review going. But normally, in a normal game, not like for tonight, I'm doing it from home. I have a small little studio in my house. It's 7:30 Eastern time game. I'm in Mountain Time. So for me, I start work at 5:30. I do sound check at 4:30. I check in with the producer. I make sure the comms are working. I talk to the play-by-play color guy. Make sure they can hear me. Make sure our audio is good. Make sure my lips are synced with the camera. And then I go grab a coffee and, you know, just hang out and puck drop. I'm focused for, you know, 2.5 hours. And when the game ends, that's it. I just shut the laptop down and go grab something to eat.
Is it difficult to watch the game on the screen and make those decisions in, if there's a call or something, rather than being there? Because obviously you were there for so many years. But now you have to watch it on a screen and make those decisions.
The tough part is, the tough part is, if it's something that happens away from the play, or if it's something that happens where the offending party only comes into the screenshot at the last second, whereas if I were to be in the press box, for example, I could see it, developing. I could see two guys going at each other behind the play, and then, you know, like a fight will start, and the announcers will go, "Oh, there's a fight!" The whistle will go, and the camera pans to the fight. That's kind of really all I'm seeing as well. Whereas if you're live, you can see this fight happening and you know what started it. Whereas I have to kind of wait and watch a couple of replays to sort of get my bearings and be able to give an informed opinion on what really happened. But there's no way I could be live at all the games. I often do double headers, an East Coast game, then a West Coast game. So I'll do two games in one night, and I have to pick which game I'm going to be at. And I work 3 to 4 nights a week sometimes. So it would be worse than when I was refereeing. I'd be I'd never be home.
Yeah. Yeah. You also were a part of the 2022 Stanley Cup final back when it was in Colorado. We were just talking about that, how it was with ESPN. What was working that final like from that rules analyst perspective, you know, after all those years of being a referee?
It was a ton of fun, mainly because I got to travel to all the games. You know, I was living in Denver, so half the games were home games for me, but I was at the rink. I was involved in all the discussions, all the pregame meetings. I'd go with the production team and, you know, listen to the coach interviews in the morning, watch the morning skate. It was really, and that's something even as a referee, you never did. Like, you just show up at the game, you know, 2 hours before the game. But you never realize what went into the production of a hockey game, TV-wise. You never realize what went into the coach's day, you know, giving press conferences in the morning, explaining their lineup decisions for that night. It was all new to me, which it was something I did for 32 years. And I was really insulated. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew what I did, and that was about it. I didn't really have any idea what went on game day for teams, for people like yourselves, for the production crews. It's a big machine.
Yeah.
And it was really cool being part of that. I was part of the finals this year as well. Mm-hmm. We flew back and forth all the way to game 7 from Fort Lauderdale to Edmonton 4 times. So it was a lot of travel and a lot of fun. Like, we were on the road for almost 3 weeks. It was great. Yeah.
Did you work any finals or playoffs when you were with the NHL as a referee?
So you had to bring that up, didn't you? No, I didn't.
You didn't? Okay.
I did not. I worked, furthest I ever worked was game 6s. I did several game 6s in the semifinals.
Okay.
And so just how it works, and it doesn't define me. Obviously, when you don't get the finals, you're upset. Mm-hmm. But I never once felt that the guys that beat me out didn't deserve it. Mm-hmm. The guys that beat me out always deserved it, always did a good job. And the thing I love about NHL officiating and how it works is you don't get the playoffs based on seniority or because it's your turn. It's all performance based. And there's just referees. There's like 36 referees. Mm. First round comes along, only 20 guys work. So like, almost half the staff goes home for the summer.
Yeah.
So you know, if you get the first round, like that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And that's based on your body of work from the whole season. That's the supervisors I talked about that go to your games. They file reports and they have meetings with the director officiating, Stephen Walkham, twice during the year. And they rank these officials. You're not made aware of where you're ranked, but you do get a mid-season letter from Stephen Walkham telling you what you're doing well and what you need to work on. So you made it. It's like a performance review at mid-season. So come playoffs, only 20 guys work. And then after the first round is over, it goes down to 12. So you get 12 referees working round 2 out of 36. It goes down to 8 for the third round. So I've been in the final 8 several times. There were times I thought I was getting the finals and I didn't. It was disappointing. But then you said, you know, I'm going to work even harder on my conditioning this summer. I'm going to be top shape. Next year's my year.
Yeah.
And then you go out in the first round, your very first game, and you miss a match penalty. And then you're back in your head. You go say to yourself, it's not my year again.
Yeah.
And I'm probably done after the first round. And that happened many times where, you know, you go, you have a good long run 1 year, and next year you think, I'm going to go even further, and you're done in the first round. It's much like a hockey team.
Yeah.
You know? Going to the finals and losing is no guarantee you're getting back the next year. You might miss the playoffs. And it's the same way with referees.
Yeah.
And it's a tough job, but I think it's good for the game that the best referees are the ones doing the best games.
Yeah. It sounds like it's a very emotional job too, from everything you've described, which is so interesting from, you know, for our fans to hear that perspective of it and to learn a bit more about the relationships you build with players and everything on the ice. How close of a community is all of the referees?
It's a hugely close community, but not just NHL referees. I think even hockey fans that referee squirt hockey feel like they are part of the brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And they are, because they're doing the same job. They're getting paid far less and getting yelled at a lot more by parents that know nothing about the rules mm-hmm. of hockey. And it's funny because my Twitter account, occasionally I will defend a call mm-hmm. and there'll be people, just true Homer hockey fans, that come after me, either just venting or getting the call wrong. And there's times I want to say stuff, but like I really can't.
Yeah.
I can just try to take the high road, but I have this whole community of followers that are referees that you know, anywhere from 14 years old to 60-year-old men that referee scored, they're sort of like my army, and they come back and like, they fight my battles for me every now and then on Twitter.
Yeah.
Which is really it's heartwarming.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's really cool. But the guys that you work with in the NHL, that's what I miss mm-hmm. about my job. I miss going to lunch on game day and talking about the game. I miss going to the locker room 2 hours before the game and just sitting there in your long johns with a coffee, just talking hockey or mm-hmm. talking about your families and your kids and stuff. A lot of camaraderie. And you think about it, like, everybody hates us to some degree.
Yeah.
They don't hate me personally. They hate this sweater with the stripes on.
Yeah.
And because everybody's against the officials sort of take this attitude that it's us against the world and we need to have each other's back. Mm-hmm. So we really do. And you make friends for life. I mean, I've been retired now 6.5 years and some of my best friends still are my best friends that I worked with for 20, 25 years mm-hmm. on the ice. And that's a bond you'll never break.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure they enjoy watching you on ESPN now.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're not shy to be critical of when I'm right or when I'm wrong. So they keep me honest. They keep my ego in check.
Dave, what's ahead for you? Anything exciting that you have coming up soon with the NHL season or ESPN?
Well, I know it sounds cliche, but I get excited for every game. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, I mean, I get paid to watch hockey. And much like I'm a hockey fan at heart. So you get people that go, oh, I can't wait to get home from work tonight because my team's playing or I'm going to watch a hockey game. Well, I feel the same way. You know, my game's on at 5:30 tonight and I don't have to prepare the way I did when I was refereeing. I don't need a pregame nap. I don't need to eat pasta for lunch or whatever, but I'm still excited. Like at 5:30, the puck drops and I get to watch a hockey game and possibly be brought in and give my opinion on things that happened. So just looking forward to that. Looking forward to the Four Nations Cup, which ESPN is taking part in, and that should be great. Mm-hmm. Just some really good hockey, and and then obviously the playoffs, which is mm-hmm. the best time of the year.
Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing you on ESPN tonight and in the future for some of these games. Thank you, Dave, so much for joining us today on Light the Lamp. It's been awesome getting to know you and hearing a bit more about your journey and to where you are today.
Well, thanks for having me, and it's a pleasure. Anytime, you know my number.
This is an Anaheim Ducks original production on DuckStream.